This is Audible.
The Girl with All the Gifts, written by M. R. Carey and read by Finty Williams. For Lynn, who opened the box. Chapter 1. Her name is Melanie. It means the black girl from an ancient Greek word, but her skin is actually very fair, so she thinks maybe it's not such a good name for her. She likes the name Pandora a whole lot, but you don't get to choose. Miss Justineau assigns names from a big list. New children get the top name on the boys' list or the top name on the girls' list, and that, Miss Justineau says, is that. There haven't been any new children for a long time now. Melanie doesn't know why that is. There used to be lots, every week or every couple of weeks. Voices in the night. Muttered orders, complaints, the occasional curse. A cell door slamming. Then, after a while, usually a month or two, a new face in the classroom. A new boy or girl who hadn't even learned to talk yet. But they got it fast. Melanie was new herself once, but that's hard to remember because it was a long time ago. It was before there were any words. There were just things without names, and things without names don't stay in your mind. They fall out, and then they're gone. Now she's 10 years old, and she has skin like a princess in a fairy tale, skin as white as snow. So she knows that when she grows up she'll be beautiful, with princes falling over themselves to climb her tower and rescue her. Assuming, of course, that she has a tower. In the meantime, she has the cell, the corridor, the classroom, and the shower room. The cell is small and square. It has a bed, a chair, and a table. On the walls, which are painted grey, there are pictures. A big one of the Amazon rainforest, and a smaller one of a pussycat drinking from a saucer of milk. Sometimes Sergeant and his people move the children around, so Melanie knows that some of the cells have different pictures in them. She used to have a horse in a meadow and a mountain with snow on the top, which she liked better. It's Miss Justineau who puts the pictures up. She cuts them out from the stack of old magazines in the classroom, and she sticks them up with bits of blue sticky stuff at the corners. She hoards the blue sticky stuff like a miser in a story. Whenever she takes a picture down or puts a new one up, she scrapes up every last bit that's stuck to the wall and puts it back on the little round ball of the stuff that she keeps in her desk. When it's gone, Miss Justineau says. The corridor has 20 doors on the left-hand side and 18 doors on the right-hand side. Also, it has a door at either end. One door is painted red and it leads to the classroom, so Melanie thinks of that as the classroom end of the corridor. The door at the other end is bare grey steel, and it's really, really thick. Where it leads to is a bit harder to say. Once, when Melanie was being taken back to her cell, the door was off its hinges with some men working on it, and she could see how it had all these bolts and sticking out bits around the edges of it. So when it's closed, it would be really hard to open. Past the door, there was a long flight of concrete steps going up and up. She wasn't supposed to see any of that stuff, and Sergeant said, "Little bitch has got way too many eyes on her." And he shoved her chair into her cell and slammed the door shut. But she saw, and she remembers. She listens, too, and from overheard conversations she has a sense of this place in relation to other places she hasn't ever seen. This place is the block. Outside the block is the base, which is Hotel Echo. Outside the base is Region 6, with London, 30 miles to the south, and then Beacon another 44 miles further. And nothing else beyond Beacon except the sea. Most of Region 6 is clear, but the only thing that keeps it that way is the burn patrols, with their frags and fireballs. This is what the base is for, Melanie is pretty sure. It sends out burn patrols to clear away the hungries. The burn patrols have to be really careful, because there are lots of hungries still out there. If they get your scent, They'll follow you for 100 miles. And when they catch you, they'll eat you. Melanie is glad that she lives in the block, behind that big steel door, where she's safe. Beacon is very different from the base. It's a whole great big city full of people, with buildings that go up into the sky. It's got the sea on one side of it, and moats and minefields on the other three, so the Hungries can't get close. In Beacon, you can live your whole life without ever seeing a Hungry. And it's so big, there are probably 100 billion people there, all living together. Melanie hopes she'll go to Beacon someday. When the mission is complete, and when, Dr. Caldwell said this once, everything gets folded up and put away. Melanie tries to imagine that day, the steel walls closing up like the pages of a book, and then something else. Something else outside, into which they'll all go. It will be scary, but so amazing. Through the grey steel door each morning, Sergeant comes, and Sergeant's people come, and finally the teacher comes. They walk down the corridor, past Melanie's door, bringing with them the strong, bitter chemical smell that they always have on them. It's not a nice smell, but it's exciting, because it means the start of another day's lessons. At the sound of the bolts sliding and the footsteps, Melanie runs to the door of her cell and stands on tiptoe to peep through the little mesh screen window in the door and see the people when they go by. She calls out good morning to them, but they're not supposed to answer, and usually they don't. Sergeant and his people never do, and neither do Dr. Caldwell or Mr. Whittaker. And Dr. Selkirk goes by really fast and never looks the right way, so Melanie can't see her face. But sometimes Melanie will get a wave from Miss Justineau or a quick, furtive smile from Miss Mailer. Whoever is going to be the teacher for the day goes straight through into the classroom, while Sergeant's people start to unlock the cell doors. Their job is to take the children to the classroom, and after that they go away again. There's a procedure that they follow which takes a long time. Melanie thinks it must be the same for all the children. But of course she doesn't know that for sure, because it always happens inside the cells, and the only cell that Melanie sees the inside of is her own. To start with, Sergeant bangs on all the doors and shouts at the children to get ready. What he usually shouts is, "Transit!" But sometimes he adds more words to that. "Transit, you little bastards!" Or, "Transit, let's see you!" His big, scarred face looms up at the mesh window, and he glares in at you, making sure you're out of bed and moving. And one time, Melanie remembers he made a speech, not to the children, but to his people. "Some of you are new. You don't know what the hell you've signed up for, and you don't know where the hell you are. You're scared of these frigging little abortions, right? Well, good. Hug that fear to your mortal soul. The more scared you are, the less chance you'll screw up." Then he shouted, "Transit!" Which was lucky because Melanie wasn't sure by then if this was the transit shout or not. After Sergeant says, "Transit," Melanie gets dressed, quickly, in the white shift that hangs on the hook next to her door, a pair of white trousers from the receptacle in the wall, and the white pumps lined up under her bed. Then she sits down in the wheelchair at the foot of her bed, like she's been taught to do. She puts her hands on the arms of the chair and her feet on the footrests. She closes her eyes and waits. She counts while she waits. The highest she's ever had to count to is 2,526. The lowest is 1,901. When the key turns in the door, she stops counting and opens her eyes. Sergeant comes in with his gun and points it at her. Then two of Sergeant's people come in and tighten and buckle the straps of the chair around Melanie's wrists and ankles. There's also a strap for her neck. They tighten that one last of all, when her hands and feet are fastened up all the way, and they always do it from behind. The strap is designed so they never have to put their hands in front of Melanie's face. Melanie sometimes says, "I won't bite." She says it as a joke, but Sergeant's people never laugh. Sergeant did once, the first time she said it. But it was a nasty laugh. And then he said, like we'd ever give you the chance, Sugar Plum. When Melanie is all strapped into the chair and she can't move her hands or her feet or her head, they wheel her into the classroom and put her at her desk. The teacher might be talking to some of the other children or writing something on the blackboard, but she, or he, if it's Mr. Whittaker, the only teacher who's a he, will usually stop and say, "Good morning, Melanie." That way, the children who sit way up at the front of the class will know that Melanie has come into the room, and they can say good morning too. Most of them can't see her when she comes in, of course, because they're all in their own chairs with their neck straps fastened up, so they can't turn their heads around that far. This procedure, the wheeling in and the teacher saying good morning, and then the chorus of greetings from the other kids, happens 9 more times, because there are 9 children who come into the classroom after Melanie. One of them is Anne, who used to be Melanie's best friend in the class, and maybe still is, except that the last time they moved the kids around, Sergeant calls it shuffling the deck, they ended up sitting a long way apart, and it's hard to be best friends with someone you can't talk to. Another is Kenny, who Melanie doesn't like because he calls her Melon Brain, or M-M-M-Melanie, to remind her that she used to stammer sometimes in class. When all the children are in the classroom, the lessons start. Every day has sums and spelling, and every day has retention tests, but there doesn't seem to be a plan for the rest of the lessons. Some teachers like to read aloud from books and then ask questions about what they just read. Others make the children learn facts and dates and tables and equations, which is something that Melanie is very good at. She knows all the kings and queens of England and when they reigned, and all the cities in the United Kingdom with their areas and populations, and the rivers that run through them, if they have rivers, and their mottos, if they have mottos. She also knows the capitals of Europe and their populations, and the years when they were at war with Britain, which most of them were at one time or another. She doesn't find it hard to remember this stuff. She does it to keep from being bored, because being bored is worse than almost anything. If she knows surface area and total population, she can work out mean population density in her head and then do regression analyses to guess how many people there might be in 10, 20, 30 years' time. But there's sort of a problem with that. Melanie learned the stuff about the cities of the United Kingdom from Mr. Whittaker's lessons, and she's not sure if she's got all the details right. Because one day, when Mr. Whittaker was acting kind of funny and his voice was all slippery and fuzzy, he said something that worried Melanie. She was asking him whether 1,036,900 was the population of the whole of Birmingham, with all its suburbs, or just the central metropolitan area, and he said, "Who cares? None of this stuff matters anymore. I just gave it to you because all the textbooks we've got are 30 years old." Melanie persisted, because she knew that Birmingham is the biggest city in England after London, and she wanted to be sure she had the numbers exactly right. "But the census figures from..." she said. Mr. Whittaker cut her off. "Jesus, Melanie, it's irrelevant. It's ancient history. There's nothing out there anymore. Not a damn thing. The population of Birmingham is zero." So it's possible, even quite likely, that some of Melanie's lists need to be updated in some respects. The children have lessons on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and Friday. On Saturday, they stay locked in their rooms all day and music plays over the PA system. Nobody comes. Not even Sergeant, and the music is too loud to talk over. Melanie had the idea long ago of making up a language that used signs instead of words, so the children could talk to each other through their little mesh windows, and she went ahead and made the language up, which was fun to do. But when she asked Miss Justineau if she could teach it to the class, Miss Justineau told her no, really loud and sharp. She made Melanie promise not to mention her sign language to any of the other teachers, and especially not to Sergeant. "He's paranoid enough already," she said. "If he thinks you're talking behind his back, he'll lose what's left of his mind." So Melanie never got to teach the other children how to talk in sign language. Saturdays are long and dull and hard to get through. Melanie tells herself aloud some of the stories that the children have been told in class, or sings mathematical proofs, like the proof for the infinity of prime numbers in Time to the Music. It's okay to do this out loud because the music hides her voice. Otherwise, Sergeant would come in and tell her to stop. Melanie knows that Sergeant is still there on Saturdays, because one Saturday, when Ronnie hit her hand against the mesh window of her cell until it bled and got all mashed up, Sergeant came in. He brought two of his people, and all three of them were dressed in the big suits that hide their faces, and they went into Ronnie's cell, and Melanie guessed from the sounds that they were trying to tie Ronnie into her chair. She also guessed from the sounds that Ronnie was struggling and making it hard for them, because she kept shouting and saying, "Leave me alone! Leave me alone!" Then there was a banging sound that went on and on, while one of Sergeant's people shouted, "Christ Jesus, don't!" And then other people were shouting too, and someone said, "Grab her other arm! Hold her!" And then it all went quiet again. Melanie couldn't tell what happened after that. The people who work for Sergeant went around and locked all the little screens over the mesh windows so the children couldn't see out. They stayed locked all day. The next Monday, Ronnie wasn't in the class anymore, and nobody seemed to know what had happened to her. Melanie likes to think there's another classroom somewhere else on the base, and Ronnie went there, so she might come back again one day, when Sergeant shuffles the deck again. But what she really believes, when she can't stop herself from thinking about it, is that Sergeant took Ronnie away to punish her for being bad, and he won't let her see any of the other children ever again. Sundays are like Saturdays, except for chow time and the shower. At the start of the day, the children are put in their chairs as though it's a regular school day, but with just their right hands and forearms unstrapped. They're wheeled into the shower room, which is the last door on the right, just before the bare steel door. In the shower room, which is white-tiled and empty, the children sit and wait until everybody has been wheeled in. Then Sergeant's people bring chow bowls and spoons. They put a bowl on each child's lap, the spoon already sticking into it. In the bowl there are about a million grubs, all squirming and wriggling over each other. The children eat. In the stories that they read, children sometimes eat other things. Cakes and chocolate and bangers and mash and crisps and sweets and spaghetti and meatballs. The children only eat grubs, and only once a week because, as Dr. Selkirk explains one time when Melanie asks, their bodies are spectacularly efficient at metabolizing proteins. They don't have to have any of those other things, not even water to drink. The grubs give them everything they need. When they've finished eating and the bowls have been taken away again, Sergeant's people go out, close the doors, and cycle the door seals. The shower room is completely dark now, because there aren't any lights in there. Pipes behind the walls start to make a sound like someone trying not to laugh, and a chemical spray falls from the ceiling. It's the same chemical that's on the teachers and Sergeant and Sergeant's people, or at least it smells the same, but it's a lot stronger. It stings a little at first, then it stings a lot. It leaves Melanie's eyes puffy, reddened and half-blind. But it evaporates quickly from clothes and skin, so after half an hour more of sitting in the still, dark room, there's nothing left of it but the smell. And then finally the smell fades too, or at least they get used to it so it's not so bad anymore. And they just wait in silence for the door to be unlocked, and Sergeant's people to come and get them. This is how the children are washed. And for that reason, if for no other, Sunday is probably the worst day of the week. The best day of the week is whichever day Miss Justineau teaches. It isn't always the same day, and some weeks she doesn't come at all. But whenever Melanie is wheeled into the classroom and sees Miss Justineau there, she feels a surge of pure happiness, like her heart flying up out of her into the sky. Nobody gets bored on Miss Justineau days. It's a thrill for Melanie even to look at her. She likes to guess what Miss Justineau will be wearing and whether her hair will be up or down. It's usually down, and it's long and black and really crinkly so it looks like a waterfall. But sometimes she ties it up in a knot on the back of her head, really tight. And that's good too, because it makes her face sort of stand out more, almost like she's a statue on the side of a temple holding up the ceiling. A caryatid. Although Miss Justineau's face stands out anyway, because it's such a wonderful, wonderful colour. It's dark brown, like the wood of the trees in Melanie's rainforest picture, whose seeds only grow out of the ashes of a bushfire, or like the coffee that Miss Justineau pours out of her flask into her cup at break time. Except it's darker and richer than either of those things, with lots of other colours mixed in, so there isn't anything you can really compare it to. All you can say is that it's as dark as Melanie's skin is light. And sometimes Miss Justineau wears a scarf or something over her shirt, tied around her neck and shoulders. On those days, Melanie thinks she looks either like a pirate or like one of the women of Hamelin when the Pied Piper came. But the women of Hamelin in the picture in Miss Justineau's book were mostly old and bent over. And Miss Justineau is young and not bent over at all, and very tall and very beautiful. So she's more like a pirate, really. Except not with long boots and not with a sword. When Miss Justineau teaches, the day is full of amazing things. Sometimes she'll read poems aloud, or bring her flute and play it, or show the children pictures out of a book and tell them stories about the people in the pictures. That was how Melanie got to find out about Pandora and Epimetheus and about the box full of all the evils of the world. Because one day, Miss J showed them a picture in the book. It was a picture of a woman opening a box and lots of really scary things coming out of it. "Who is that?" Anne asked Miss Justineau. "That's Pandora," Miss Justineau said. She was a really amazing woman. All the gods had blessed her and given her gifts. That's what her name means, the girl with all the gifts. So she was clever and brave and beautiful and funny and everything else you'd want to be. But she just had the one tiny fault, which was that she was very, and I mean very, curious. She had the kids hooked by this point, and they were loving it, and so was she. And in the end, they got the whole story, which started with the war between the gods and the Titans, and ended with Pandora opening up the box and letting all the terrible things out. Melanie said she didn't think it was right to blame Pandora for what happened, because it was a trap that Zeus had set for mortals, and he made her be the way she was on purpose, just so the trap would get sprung. "Say it loud, sister," Miss Justineau said. "Men get the pleasure, women get the rap." And she laughed. Melanie made Miss Justineau laugh. That was a really good day, even if she doesn't know what she said that was funny. The only problem with the days when Miss Justineau teaches is that the time goes by too quickly. Every second is so precious to Melanie that she doesn't even blink. She just sits there wide-eyed, drinking in everything that Miss Justineau says and memorising it so that she can play it back to herself later in her cell. And whenever she can manage it, she asks Miss Justineau questions, because what she most likes to hear, and to remember, is Miss Justineau's voice saying her name, Melanie, in that way that makes her feel like the most important person in the world. Chapter 2. One time, Sergeant comes into the classroom on a Miss Justineau day. Melanie doesn't know why he's there until he speaks, because he's standing right at the back of the class. When Miss Justineau says, "And this time, Pooh and Piglet counted 3 sets of footprints in the snow," Sergeant's voice breaks in with, "What the hell is this?" Miss Justineau stops and looks around. "I'm reading the children a story, Sergeant Parks," she says. "I can see that," Sergeant's voice says. I thought the idea was to put them through their paces, not give them a cabaret. Miss Justineau tenses. If you didn't know her as well as Melanie knows her, and if you didn't watch her as closely as Melanie watches her, you'd most likely miss it. It's gone again really quickly, and her voice when she speaks sounds just the same as it always does. Not angry at all. That's exactly what we're doing, she says. It's important to see how they process information, but there has to be input, so there can be output. Input, Sergeant repeats. You mean facts? No, not just facts, ideas. Oh, yeah, plenty of world-class ideas in Winnie the Pooh. Sergeant is using sarcasm. Melanie knows how sarcasm works. You say the opposite of what you really mean. Seriously, you're wasting your time. You want to tell them stories? Tell them about Jack the Ripper and John Wayne Gacy. They're children, Miss Justineau points out. No. Psychologically speaking, yes, they're children. Well, then fuck psychology, Sergeant says, sounding kind of angry now. That, what you said right there, that's why you don't want to read them Winnie the Pooh. You carry on that way, you'll start thinking of them as real kids, and then you'll slip up. And maybe you'll untie one of them because he needs a cuddle or something. I don't need to tell you what happens after that. Sergeant comes out to the front of the class then, and he does something really horrible. He rolls up his sleeve, all the way to the elbow, and he holds his bare forearm in front of Kenny's face, right in front of Kenny, just an inch or so away from him. Nothing happens at first, but then Sergeant spits on his hand and rubs at his forearm, like he's wiping something away. Don't, says Miss Justineau, don't do that to him. But Sergeant doesn't answer her or look at her. Melanie sits two rows behind Kenny and two rows over so she can see the whole thing. Kenny goes really stiff and then his mouth gapes wide and he starts to snap at Sergeant's arm, which of course he can't reach, and drool starts to drip down from the corner of his mouth, but not much of it because nobody ever gives the children anything to drink. So it's thick, half solid, and it hangs there on the end of Kenny's chin, wobbling, while Kenny grunts and snaps at Sergeant's arm and makes kind of moaning, whimpering sounds. And bad as that is, it gets worse. Because the kids on either side of Kenny start doing it too, as though it's something they've caught from Kenny, and the kids right behind him twitch and shake as though someone is poking them really hard in the stomach. You see? Sergeant says, and he turns to look at Miss Justineau's face to make sure she gets his point. And then he blinks, all surprised. And maybe he wishes he hadn't looked at her, because Miss Justineau is glaring at him like she wants to smack him in the face. And Sergeant lets his arm fall to his side and shrugs like none of this was ever important to him anyway. Not everyone who looks human is human, he says. No, Miss Justineau agrees. I'm with you on that one. Kenny's head sags a little sideways, which is as far as it can move because of the strap, and he makes a clicking sound in his throat. It's all right, Kenny, Miss Justineau says. It will pass soon. Let's go on with the story. Would you like that? Would you like to hear what happened to Pooh and Piglet? Sergeant Parks, if you'll excuse us. Please? Sergeant looks at her and shakes his head really hard. You don't want to get attached to them, he says. You know what they're here for. Hell, you know better than... But Miss Justineau starts to read again, like she can't hear him, like he's not even there, and in the end, he leaves. Or maybe he's still standing at the back of the classroom, not speaking. But Melanie doesn't think so, because after a while Miss Justineau gets up and shuts the door, and Melanie thinks that she'd only do that right then, if Sergeant was on the other side of it. Melanie barely sleeps at all that night. She keeps thinking about what Sergeant said, that the children aren't real children. and about how Miss Justineau looked at him when he was being so nasty to Kenny. And she thinks about Kenny snarling and snapping at Sergeant's arm like a dog. She wonders why he did it, and she thinks maybe she knows the answer, because when Sergeant wiped his arm with spit and waved it under Kenny's nose, it was as though under the bitter chemical smell, Sergeant had a different smell altogether. And even though the smell was very faint where Melanie was, it made her head swim and her jaw muscles start to work by themselves. She can't even figure out what it was she was feeling, because it's not like anything that ever happened to her before or anything she heard about in a story, but it was like there was something she was supposed to do. And it was so urgent, so important, that her body was trying to take over her mind and do it without her. But along with these scary thoughts, she also thinks, Sergeant has a name. The same way the teachers do. The same way the children do. Up until now, Sergeant has been more like a god or a titan to Melanie. Now she knows that he's just like everyone else, even if he is scary. He's not just Sergeant. He's Sergeant Parks. The enormity of that change, more than anything else, is what keeps her awake until the doors unlock in the morning and the teachers come. In a way, Melanie's feelings about Miss Justineau have changed too after that day. Or rather, they haven't changed at all, but they've become about 100 times stronger. There can't be anyone better or kinder or lovelier than Miss Justineau anywhere in the world. Melanie wishes she was a god or a titan or a Trojan warrior so she could fight for Miss Justineau and save her from heffalumps and woozles. She knows that heffalumps and woozles are in Winnie the Pooh, not in a Greek myth, but she likes the words, and she likes the idea of saving Miss Justineau so much that it becomes her favourite thought. She thinks about it whenever she's not thinking about anything else. It makes even Sundays bearable. So one day, when Miss Mailer unstraps everybody's right arms from the elbow down, slots the tray tables onto their chairs and tells them to write a story, that's the story that Melanie writes. Miss Mailer is only interested in their vocabulary, of course, and doesn't care much at all what their stories are about. This is really obvious, because she gives out a word list alongside the assignment and tells the class that every word from the word list they use correctly gets them an extra point in the assessment. Melanie ignores the word list and cuts loose. When Miss Mailer asks who would like to read their story aloud, she's the first to wave, as far as you can wave with just your forearm free, and say, "Me, Miss Mailer, pick me." So she gets to read her story, which goes like this. Once upon a time there was a very beautiful woman, the most beautiful and kind and clever and amazing woman in all the world. She was tall and not bent over, with skin so dark she was like her own shadow, and long black hair that curled around so much it made you dizzy to look at her. And she lived in ancient Greece, after the war between the gods and the Titans, when the gods had already won. And one day, as she was walking in a forest, she was attacked by a monster. It was a frigging abortion, and it wanted to kill her and eat her. The woman was really brave, and she fought and fought, but the monster was very big and very fierce, and it didn't matter how many times she wounded it, it just kept on coming. The woman was afraid. She hugged her fear to her mortal soul. The monster broke her sword and her spear, and it was about to eat her. But then a little girl came along. She was a special little girl made by all the gods, like Pandora. And she was like Achilles, too, because her mother, the beautiful, amazing woman, had dipped her into the water of the river Styx. So she was all invulnerable except for one little part of her. But it wasn't her heel, because that's obvious. It was a place that she kept secret so the monster couldn't find it. And the little girl fought the monster and killed it and cut off its head and its arms and its legs and all the other bits of it. And the beautiful woman hugged her to her mortal soul and said, "You are my special girl. You will always be with me, and I will never let you go." And they lived together forever after, in great peace and prosperity. The last sentence is stolen word for word from a story by the Brothers Grimm that Miss Justineau read to the class once, and some of the other bits are sort of borrowed from Miss Justineau's Greek myths book, which is called Tales the Muses Told, or just from cool things she's heard people say. But it's still Melanie's story, and she's very happy when the other kids all say how good it is. Even Kenny, in the end, says he liked the part where the monster got chopped up. Miss Mailer seems happy too. The whole time Melanie was reading the story out, she was scribbling in her notebook, and she recorded the reading on her little hand recorder machine. Melanie hopes she'll play it back to Miss Justineau, so Miss Justineau will get to hear it too. "That was really interesting, Melanie," Miss Mailer says. She puts the recorder down on Melanie's tray table, right in front of her, and asks her a lot of questions about the story. What did the monster look like? How did the girl feel about the monster when it was alive? How did she feel about it after it was dead? How did she feel about the woman? And lots of stuff like that, which is kind of fun because it feels almost like the people in the story are real somewhere. Like she saved Miss Justineau from a monster, and Miss Justineau hugged her. Which is better than a million Greek myths. Chapter 3. One day, Miss Justineau talks to them about death. It's because most of the men in the Light Brigade have just died, in a poem that Miss Justineau read to the class. The children want to know what it means to die, and what it's like. Miss Justineau says it's like all the lights going out, and everything going really quiet, the way it does at night, but forever. No mourning. The lights never come back on again.
"That sounds terrible,"
says Lizzie in a voice like she's about to cry. It sounds terrible to Melanie, too, like sitting in the shower room on Sunday with the chemical smell in the air, and then even the smell goes away, and there's nothing at all, forever and ever. Miss Justineau can see that she's upset them, and she tries to make it okay again by talking about it more. "But maybe it's not like that at all," she says quickly. "Nobody really knows, because when you're dead, you can't come back to talk about it. And, anyway, it would be different for you than it would be for most people, because you're..." And then she stops herself, with the next word sort of frozen halfway out of her lips.
"We're what?"
Melanie asks. It's a moment or two before Miss Justineau says anything. It looks to Melanie like she's thinking of something to say that won't make them feel any worse than they do already. "Your children. You can't really imagine what death might be like, because for children it seems like everything has to go on forever." That isn't what she was going to say. Melanie is pretty sure. But it's really interesting just the same. There's a silence while they think about it. It's true, Melanie decides. She can't remember a time when her life was any different than this, and she can't imagine any other way that people could live. But there's something that doesn't make sense to her in the whole equation, and so she has to ask the question. "Whose children are we, Miss Justineau?" In most stories, she knows, children have a mother and a father, like Iphigenia had Clytemnestra and Agamemnon, and Helen had Leda and Zeus. Sometimes they have teachers too, but not always, and they never seem to have sergeants. So this is a question that gets to the very roots of the world, and Melanie asks it with some trepidation. Again, Miss Justineau thinks about it for a long time, until Melanie is sure she won't answer. Then she says, "Your mother is dead, Melanie. She died when you were very little. Probably your daddy's dead too, although there isn't really any way of knowing. So, the army is looking after you now."
"Is that just Melanie?" John asks. "Or is it all of us?"
Miss Justineau nods slowly. "All of you."
"We're in an orphanage,"
Anne guesses. The class heard the story of Oliver Twist once, on another Miss Justineau day. No, you're on an army base.
Is that what happens to kids whose mum and dad die?
This is Stephen now. Sometimes. Melanie is thinking hard and putting all these facts together inside her head, like they're pieces of a puzzle.
How old was I,
she asks, when my mother died? Because she must have been very young if she can't remember her mother at all.
It's not easy to explain,
Miss Justineau says, and they can see from her face that she's really not comfortable talking about this stuff.
Was I still a baby?
Melanie asks.
Not really,
but almost. You were very young.
And did my mother give me to the army?
Another long silence. No, Miss Justineau says at last. The army pretty much helped itself. It comes out quick and low and almost hard. Miss Justineau changes the subject then, and the children are happy to let her do it because nobody is very enthusiastic about death by this point. So they do the periodic table of the elements, which is easy and fun. Starting with Miles in the front row at the very end, everyone takes turns to name an element. First time around, they do it in straight number order. Then they reverse it. Then Miss Justineau shouts out challenges like, has to start with the letter N, or actinides only. Nobody drops out until the challenges get really hard, like can't follow in group or period and has to start with a letter that's in your name. Zoe complains that that means people with long names have more chances, and she's right, obviously, but she's still got zinc, zirconium, oxygen, osmium, einsteinium, erbium and europium to choose from, so she's not doing too badly. By the time Xanthi wins with xenon, everyone is laughing, and it looks as though all the death stuff is forgotten. It isn't, of course. Melanie knows her classmates well enough to be sure that they're turning Miss Justineau's words over and over in their minds, the same way she is, shaking them and worrying at them to see what insights might fall out. Because the one thing they never learn about, really, is themselves. And by this time, Melanie has thought of the big exception to that rule about kids having mothers and fathers. Pandora, who didn't have a mother or a father because Zeus just made her out of gloopy clay. Melanie thinks that that would be better, in some ways, than having a mother and a father who you never even got to meet. The ghost of her parents' absence hovers around her, makes her uneasy. But she wants to know one more thing. And she wants it badly enough that she even takes the chance of upsetting Miss Justineau some more. At the end of the lesson, she waits until Miss Justineau is close to her, and she asks her question really quietly. Miss Justineau, what will happen when we're grown up? Will the army still want to keep us, or will we go home to Beacon? And if we go there, will all the teachers come with us? All the teachers. Yeah, right. Like she cares if she ever sees Mr. Slippery Voice Whittaker again, or boring Dr. Selkirk, who looks at the ground the whole time like she's scared of even seeing the class.
She means you, Miss Justineau. You. 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 And she wants to say it. But at the same time, she's scared to. Like saying the wish out loud will make it not happen.
And she knows, again, extrapolating from the stories she's read or heard, that children don't stay in school forever. They don't set up home with their teachers and live there and be there with them when school is finished. And although she doesn't really know what those words mean, what school being finished could possibly be like, she accepts that it will someday happen, and therefore that something else will start. So she's ready for Miss Justineau to say no. She's hardened herself to let nothing show in her face if that's the answer. She really just wants the facts, so she can prepare herself for the grief of separation. But Miss Justineau doesn't answer at all, unless the quick movement of her hand is an answer. She puts it up in front of her own face as though Melanie has thrown something at her, which Melanie never, ever would do in a million years. Then the siren whoops three times to signal the end of the day, and Miss Justineau ducks her head, pulling herself together after that imaginary blow. And it's sort of a strange thing, but for the first time Melanie realises that Miss Justineau always wears red, somewhere on her. Her T-shirt, or her hairband, or her trousers, or her scarf. All the other teachers and Dr. Caldwell and Dr. Selkirk wear white, and Sergeant and Sergeant's people wear green and brown and greeny-brown. Miss Justineau is red. Like blood. Like something about her is wounded and not healing and hurting her all the time. That's a stupid idea, Melanie thinks, because Miss Justineau always smiles and laughs, and her voice is like a song. If something was hurting her, she wouldn't be able to smile so much. But right then, Miss Justineau isn't smiling at all. She's staring down at the ground, and her face is all twisted up like she's angry, sad, sick, like something bad is going to come out of her anyway, and it might be tears or words or vomit or all three. "I'll stay," Melanie blurts. She's desperate to make Miss Justineau feel okay again. "If you have to stay here, I'll stay with you. I wouldn't want to be in Beacon without you there." Miss Justineau lifts her head and looks at Melanie again. Her eyes are very shiny, and her mouth is like the line on Dr. Caldwell's EEG machine, changing all the time. "I'm sorry," Melanie says quickly. "Please don't be sad, Miss Justineau. You can do whatever you want to do, of course you can. You can go or stay or..." She doesn't get another word out. She crashes into total, tongue-tied silence because something completely unexpected and absolutely wonderful happens. Miss Justineau puts out her hand and strokes Melanie's hair. She strokes Melanie's hair with her hand like it was just the most natural and normal thing in the world. And lights are dancing behind Melanie's eyes, and she can't get her breath, and she can't speak or hear or think about anything, because apart from Sergeant's people, maybe two or three times and always by accident, nobody has ever touched her before. And this is Miss Justineau touching her, and it's almost too nice to be in the world at all. Everybody in the class who can see is watching. Everybody's eyes and mouths are big and wide. So quiet, you can hear Miss Justineau draw a breath, with a little tremor at the end of it, as though she's shivering from cold. "Oh God," she whispers.
"Here endeth the lesson," says Sergeant.
Melanie can't turn her head to look at him because of the neck strap on her chair. Nobody else seems to have seen Sergeant come into the room either. They're all just as surprised and scared as she is. Even Miss Justineau looks scared, which is another one of those things, like Sergeant having a name, that changes the architecture of the whole world. Sergeant walks into Melanie's line of sight, right behind Miss Justineau. Miss Justineau has already snatched her hand away from Melanie's hair as soon as Sergeant spoke. She ducks her head again so Melanie can't see her face.
"They go back now," Sergeant says.
"Right." Miss Justineau's voice is very small.
"And you go on a charge."
"Right."
"And maybe you lose your job, because every rule we got, you just broke."
Miss Justineau brings her head up again. Both her eyes are wet with tears now.
"Fuck you, Eddie," she says, as quietly and calmly as if she was saying good morning.
She walks out of Melanie's line of sight very quickly. Melanie wants to call her back, wants to say something to make her stay. "I love you, Miss Justineau,"
I'll be a god or a titan for you and save you.
But she can't say anything. And then Sergeant's people come and start to wheel the kids away, one by one. Chapter 4.
Why? Why did she do that?
Helen Justinu has no good answer, so she just keeps on asking herself the question. Stands forlorn in her room in the luxuriously appointed civilian block, a foot on every side bigger than a regular soldier's room, and with an ensuite chemical toilet. Leaning against the mirror on the wall, avoiding her own sick, accusing gaze. She scrubbed her hands until they were raw, but she can still feel that cold flesh. So cold, as though blood never ran in it. As though she was touching something that had just been dredged up from the bottom of the sea. Why did she do it? What happened in that laying on of hands? Nice cop is just a role she plays, observing and measuring the children's emotional responses to her so she can write mealy-mouthed reports for Caroline Cordwell about their capacity for normal effect. Normal effect. That's what Justinu is feeling now, presumably. It's like she's dug a pit trap, nice and deep, squared off the edges, wiped her hands, then walked right into it. Except that it was test subject number one, really, who dug the pit. Melanie. It was her desperate, obvious, hero-worshipping crush that tripped Justinu up, or at least threw her far enough off balance that tripping became inevitable. Those big, trusting eyes in that bone-white face. Death and the Maiden, all wrapped up in one tiny package. She didn't turn the compassion off in time. She didn't remind herself, the way she does at the start of every day, that when the program wraps up, Beacon will airlift her out of here the same way they airlifted her in. Quick and easy, taking all her things with her, leaving no footprint. This isn't life. It's something that's playing out in its own self-contained subroutine. She can walk out as clean as when she came in, if she just doesn't let anything touch her. That horse, however, may already have bolted. Chapter 5. Every once in a while in the block, there's a day that doesn't start right. A day when all the repeating patterns that Melanie uses as measuring sticks for her life fail to occur, one after another, and she feels like she's bobbing around helplessly in the air. A Melanie-shaped balloon. The week after Miss Justinu told the class that their mothers were dead, there's a day like that. It's a Friday, but when Sergeant and his people arrive, they don't bring a teacher with them, and they don't open the cell doors. Melanie already knows what's going to happen next, but she still feels a prickle of unease when she hears the clacking of Dr. Caldwell's high-heel shoes on the concrete floor. And then a moment or two later, she hears the sound of Dr. Caldwell's pen, which Dr. Caldwell will sometimes keep clicking on and off and on and off, even when she doesn't want to write anything. Melanie doesn't get up off the bed. She just sits there and waits. She doesn't like Dr. Caldwell very much. That's partly because the rhythms of the day get disrupted whenever Dr. Caldwell shows up, but it's mostly because she doesn't know what Dr. Caldwell is for. The teachers teach, and Sergeant's people take the kids back and forth between the classroom and the cells, and feed them and shower them on Sundays. Dr. Caldwell just appears, at unforeseeable times. Melanie tried to work out once if there was a pattern, but she couldn't find one. And everyone stops doing what they were doing, or what they're meant to do, until she's gone again. The clacking of the shoes and the clicking of the pen get louder and louder, and then stop. "Good morning, Doctor," Sergeant says out in the corridor. "To what do we owe the pleasure?" "Sergeant," Dr. Caldwell answers. Her voice is almost as soft and warm as Miss Justineau's, which makes Melanie feel a little bit guilty about not liking her. She's probably really nice if you get to know her. I'm starting a new test series, and I need one of each.
One of each, Sergeant repeats. You mean a boy and a girl?
A what and a what? Dr. Caldwell laughs musically. No, I don't mean that at all. The gender is completely irrelevant. We've established that much. I meant high and low end of the bell curve.
Well, you just tell me which ones you want. I'll pack them up and bring them over.
There's a rustling of papers. 16 should do fine for the lower end, Dr. Caldwell says. Her heel taps on the floor of the corridor a few times, but she's not walking because the sound doesn't get louder or softer. Her pen clicks.
You want this one?
Sergeant asks. His voice sounds really close. Melanie looks up. Dr. Caldwell is looking in through the grill in her cell door. Her eyes meet Melanie's for a long time, and neither of them blinks. Our little genius, Dr. Caldwell says. Wash your mouth out, Sergeant. I'm not going to waste number one on a simple stratum comp. When I come for Melanie, there'll be angels and trumpets. Sergeant mutters something Melanie can't hear, and Dr. Caldwell laughs. Well, I'm sure you can supply some trumpets, at least. She turns away, and the click-clack-click of her heels recedes along the corridor. Two little ducks, she calls. 22. Melanie doesn't know the cell numbers for all the kids, but she remembers most of them from when a teacher has called someone in the class by their number instead of their name. Marcia is number 16, and Liam is number 22. She wonders what Dr. Caldwell wants them for, and what she'll say to them. She goes to the grill and watches Sergeant's people go into cell 16 and cell 22. They wheel Liam and Marcia out, and down the corridor, not towards the classroom, but the other way, towards the big steel door. Melanie watches them as far as she can, but they go further than that. She thinks they have to have gone through the door, because what else is down at the end of the corridor? They're seeing with their own eyes what's outside the door. Melanie hopes it's a Miss Justineau day, because Miss Justineau lets the kids talk to each other about stuff that's not in the lesson. So when Liam and Marcia come back, she'll be able to ask them what Dr. Caldwell talked to them about, and what they did, and what's on the far side of the door. Of course, she hopes it will be a Miss Justineau day for a lot of other reasons, too. And it turns out it is. The children make up songs for Miss Justineau to play on her flute, with complicated rules for how long the words are and how they rhyme. They have great fun. But the day goes on, and Liam and Marcia don't come back. So Melanie can't ask, and she goes back to her cell that night with her curiosity, if anything, burning even brighter. Then it's the weekend, with no lessons and no talking. All through Saturday, Melanie listens, but the steel door doesn't open, and nobody comes or goes. Liam and Marcia aren't in the shower on Sunday. And Monday is Miss Mailer, and Tuesday is Mr. Whittaker, and somehow after that, Melanie feels afraid to ask, because the possibility has opened up in her mind, like a crack in a wall, that Liam and Marcia might not come back at all, the same way Ronnie didn't come back after she shouted and screamed that time. And maybe asking the question will change what happens. Maybe if they all pretend not to notice, Liam and Marcia will be wheeled in one day, and it will be like they never went away. But if anyone asks, where did they go to? Then they'll really be gone, and she'll never see them again. Chapter 6. Okay, Miss Justineau says. Does anyone know what today is? It's Tuesday, obviously. And more important than that, It's a Miss Justineau day. But everyone tries to guess what else it might be.
Your birthday? The King's birthday. The day when something important happened years ago.